Torah says that maybe there's somebody who will not be interested in including himself in the community and not accept upon himself the responsibility of the Torah and silently say, Bishrirus libi elech, I'll do what I want and everything will be okay with me. And the Torah describes such a person as Shoresh Pore Rosh Valana. He is a root that will sprout into a bitter poison. The Ramban says a very interesting idea about this, and it explains to a certain degree something very difficult to understand, at least from one perspective. Okay, now that I've confused you enough, I'll tell you what I'm talking about. We find that by certain sins, at least, could be only by Avodah Zarah, it could be other sins, the Rabban Hashem is poked avon avos albonim, that the Rabban Hashem visits the sins of the fathers on the children. And the Gemara itself asks the question, that's not fair. Right? Lo yumsu avos albonim, another pasuk says, children don't die for the sins of their parents, and parents don't suffer for the sins of their children. Ish bechet, everybody gets punished for their own sins. Yet the Torah says that seems that children can be punished for the sins of the fathers. So the Gemara, in one of the qualifications that explains this contradiction, the Gemara says that kan kisha ochzim ma'asei avoseim b'yadehem, the kan kisha ein ochzim ma'asei avoseim b'yadehem. It depends if they continue to do the sins of the parents, then they're punished for the sins of the parents. But when they don't have the sins of the parents, they don't continue doing the sins of the parents, then they're only punished for their own sins. Which on the surface doesn't seem to answer the question. Right? If the father was a bank robber, and the child continues and he's also a bank robber, so he's going to get punished for his sin of bank robbing and also for his father's sin. Okay? But if the child is not a bank robber, right, he is a, he's a murderer. Right, so he'll only get punished for his murder because his parents didn't murder, and he won't get punished for what the parents did. Okay, still doesn't make any sense. Why should the kid be punished for what the father did just because he does the same sin? Right, so still you need to understand why there's a difference between ochzim ma'aseh avoseihem v'yadehem and not. The Ramban here says something that with that we can understand this concept. And that's the following. We normally think that sin and reward and punishment is totally a very ethereal, nebulous, not concrete thing. In other words, somebody made a sin, God has a complaint against him, so God punishes him. But it's not like that. A sin is an entity. It creates a result. An effect. It's real. It's there. It's like a poison in a person. And the sin itself is part of the punishment. It's like a poison that a person creates within him and it affects him. It harms him. That is part of the punishment. Part of the punishment is the sin itself creates a poison. So that poison, says the Ramban, doesn't stop after one generation. It goes on like genetics. It's part of the makeup of a person and it goes on into his children. Now, the child has the ability to obliterate it. To literally, the Torah says, Ochzin ma'aseh avoseihem b'yadehem. They are holding on to the actions of the fathers in their hand. It's not that they're continuing the sin. They now possess the same poison that the father had in his system passed on to the child. Just like in physical things. A child can be born a drug addict. A child can be born with AIDS. Right? Because the parent had it in their system. Now, the Ribbono Shel Olam, though, is a lot more merciful when it comes to spiritual things and perhaps with physical things. Because if the child disassociates himself from what the parent did, then he can totally uproot what the parent did, and it makes no effect on him. But if he doesn't, so then it's like Shorish Pore Rosh Valana means the following. It starts by the father as a root. Could be the father never really did the sin, but he contemplated doing the sin. He did it in a very light manner. So he passes on that effect of the sin, like a root, into his child. But by the child, it's no longer a root, it already sprouts into a little, a sapling. If the child disassociates himself from that root, it dies and has no effect on him. If he doesn't hold on to it, then it doesn't affect him. But if he holds on to it and he continues doing that sin, so the sin no longer is just a little sapling, it now becomes a little tree. If he passes that little tree now onto his children, they can disassociate themselves, the tree will shrivel up and die. If they don't and they continue that same sin, then they are nurturing that little tree into a big tree. And finally, by idolatry at least, after four generations, the tree is a giant redwood that is almost impossible to uproot, and therefore the Rebbe Shlomo already destroys the family. That's a possibility of four generations of idolatry, right? Intentional idolatry. Could be the family's destroyed. But it takes four generations to incubate that root into a giant redwood. But that's the idea. Sin is not merely a fantasy. It's not just something, you know, floating around, something that God has a complaint. It is real. It's a poison. And it can be passed on from generation to generation, the effect of the sin. If the coming generation disassociates themselves from it, it dies away. It doesn't have any nourishment. And it's irrelevant. If the coming generation decides to nurture it and to continue it, then it doesn't start from the same level that it started the generation before. It starts on the more mature level and then is added to. So the person gets punished not just for his sin, but if the poison is now accumulated from the previous generation. It's not that God's going to punish him for what his father did. It doesn't work with that kind of punishment. The extrinsic, but the punishment from the king. But the intrinsic punishment of the sin, the effect of the sin, is is compounded as it goes from generation to generation. That's the idea of shore pore rosh velama. Okay. Any questions on that? Is that understood? I think I tried to explain at least the best that I could. Okay. And it all goes back to what we spoke about at some different point, which maybe we'll mention now because it also has to do with the second Sedra. And that is there's two effects of a sin. One is you rebelled against the king who commanded you not to do it. And the second is that you created a sickness because of that sin that affects you. And we said that most sins have both things. God said, don't eat treif. If you eat treif, you're going to be punished because you rebelled against God. And you're also going to be punished because the treif is going to poison your neshama to a certain degree. So the punishment is going to come both from the inside and from the outside. The king will punish you, and the sin itself will punish you. And we said that's why there's yiras shamayim and yiras chet. You're afraid of heaven because you're afraid that God is going to punish you, and you're afraid of the chet itself. The sin itself is a poison. The sin itself is going to hurt you. Most sins and mitzvahs is the opposite. You'll get rewarded by the king for fulfilling his command, and there's also an intrinsic benefit of doing the mitzvahs, like a vitamin. Most sins and most mitzvahs have both parts, but there are exceptions. One of the exceptions is in this week's Sedra, this coming week's Sedra. It says that when you go to Hakel, once every, at the end of 7 years, after Shemitah, all the Jewish people, men, women, children, even infants, have to come on Motzoi, the first day of Sukkot, and hear the king read from Sefer Devarim. And that is called Hakel. It's like a reacceptance of the covenant. It's like a reenactment of Maimon Har Sinai. Everybody comes. No exception. So the Gemara says, I understand, men come to learn and women come to hear, but what do little babies have to come? What do they gain? The Gemara's answer is, Litein Socher L'Mivieim. The purpose of bringing the little babies is to give reward to the people who bring them. So if that means that there is an intrinsic value to bringing the little babies, tell me what it is. They should be in the atmosphere, and it should be by osmosis. They sop in this tremendous occurrence. Then say that. Obviously, there is absolutely no benefit for these little babies. So what's the purpose? To give reward to the people who brought them. So the Shurei Das explains what it means as the following. This is one of the exceptions of a mitzvah where there is no intrinsic value, no intrinsic benefit from the mitzvah. There is no real intrinsic reason to bring a baby to Hakel. But God knew you're going to have to bring the babies, because there's no babysitters. Everybody has to be there. So you can't leave them home with anybody. You can't leave them with the Polish maid, right? You're going to, what's it called, bring your babies to Hakel because of necessity. So God said, I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to make it a mitzvah. And if you do it for the sake of the mitzvah, I'll reward you. Even though there's no intrinsic benefit, I'll give you a reward as the king if you do it for the sake of the mitzvah. So here's a case where there's a mitzvah and the king will benefit you, even though there's no intrinsic benefit from the mitzvah at all. It's only a command of the king. This is one of the exceptions. That's how he explains this idea.
Can we have this idea for every mitzvah?
What?
We have this idea for every mitzvah. Every mitzvah we're doing it because...
Yeah. But there's also an intrinsic value. Now, as the Torah said, eat matzah. You're going to get rewarded for listening to the command. But the matzah also is going to affect your neshama. There's a positive benefit of eating matzah. Intrinsic. Not only because you listen to God's. And therefore it's possible, even if you eat the matzah and you don't have intention to do a mitzvah, but you know it's matzah and you know it's Pesach, and you eat it, you'll have a benefit. You won't have the benefit of listening to the king, but you'll have the benefit that the matzah gives you. Okay. Let's go on to something else. Right after that it says, Leman Sfos Harova Es Hatzmeya. A person like this, who totally disregards the Torah and does whatever he wants. So Rashi says he's going to be punished not only for the things he does intentionally, he's going to be punished even for things he does unintentionally. Normally, if a person is a Shomer Torah mitzvah and he wants to eat kosher, and by accident he eats something not kosher, he wants to keep Shabbos by accident, by unintentionally he thinks it's Sunday and it's not Shabbos and he turns on the light. And then he finds out it's Shabbos. He's not going to be punished with the same severity for an unintentional sin as for an intentional sin. But somebody who doesn't believe in Shabbos, he wouldn't keep Shabbos anyway. And he thinks it's Sunday and he turns on the light on Shabbos. He's going to be punished as if he did it intentionally. Because even if he would have known it was Shabbos, he would have turned on the light. He totally disregards the whole system. So whenever he does a sin, it's out of disregard for the whole system, it's intentional. So that's what Rashi means. Not only going to be punished for the intentional things, that goes for people who accept the system. Somebody who totally rejects the system is going to be punished for anything he does, even unintentional. Because even if you would have known, you would have done it. Okay, that's Rashi. The Ramban says something else. The Ramban says, Rava means something that your thirst is quenched for. Tzmeya is something that you are thirsty for. Normally, there are sins that a person is thirsty for. And then there are sins that your Yetzer Hara is quenched. You're not really thirsty for them. When you let yourself go, and you say, I'll do whatever comes to mind, whatever I want, do it. Right? If it feels good, do it. That philosophy. Then what's going to happen is that the quenched will overtake the thirsty. Now let me explain what that means. Tell you a story. I may have told this before, but there's some new faces here, so we'll... When I was about 5-6 years old, I remember we had a black and white television with a little, looked like a microwave oven, I think. I remember watching on TV a gala extravaganza that was going on in Hollywood at the time that they were reporting. What's his name? Oh, you know, I always forget the name. It's on the tip of my tongue. I'll think of it. No, there was a producer who finished the picture Around the World in 80 Days. was an extravaganza picture.
That was what?
No. Who? No, it wasn't Cecil with the mill. It was, okay, whatever it was out there, I remember it. So,
that's all the story, because you didn't remember the name.
But I remembered the name afterwards. But I did remember the name afterwards. No. It wasn't any of these people. It was, okay, well, it's not important right now. Right now, we'll just leave it. Well, no, I remember that. Okay, let's forget about the guy. Whoever it was. Right. I'll remember it as soon as I leave here. In any case, right now I'm working on who I am. As soon as I remember that, I'll remember who this guy is. It didn't make a difference. He threw a tremendous party for all the people involved in the picture and all the great personalities in Hollywood, and they were reporting it live on television. I was a 6-year-old watching this, and I was and then I heard them say that one of the courses, like they had this big smorgasbord. And one of the courses at the smorgasbord was chocolate-covered ants. And I remember thinking to myself, "Guy, the guy must have spent so much money, he didn't have money to buy normal food. They had to go around picking up all the ants, but put chocolate on them, and that was never what he could serve these people." Nobody in their right mind has a burning desire, right, to eat ants, whether they are chocolate-covered or not. Okay, normally you walk into your kitchen and see a horde of ants all over. You don't say, "Wow, lunch," right? You get out the raid and you destroy them. Okay, why in the world would rich people, who obviously could afford a lot better things, serve chocolate-covered ants? The answer, says the Ramban, is the following. A person who does not control his desires and gives in to every desire, so the normal desires that people have become hackneyed, and familiarity breeds contempt. And you get used to it, and you don't get any enjoyment out of it. It doesn't give you the thrill that it initially gave when it's not something that you can have all the time, and you have all the time. Then, if you're the kind of person who is a thrill seeker and a pleasure seeker, and these normal things don't give you pleasure and thrills, then you have to go on to things that are not normal in order to get your pleasure. That's the root of a drug culture, is this idea. People who all the normal thrills and pleasures become commonplace and hackneyed need to create artificial thrills and pleasures. Right? It's not the only reason why people turn to drugs, but it's one of the reasons. And the same thing goes. The very unnatural desires that normal people in their wildest dreams don't normally want these things, but they become the want of people who have exhausted every other normal desire and therefore have to create new desires. That's the man shvos harava esatzmeil. What's going to happen is that which your yetzer hara is normally quenched to is going to overtake those yetzer haras that you normally desire and are thirsty for, and you're going to add the quenched ones to the desired ones. If you just do whatever comes to mind, do it. If it feels good, do it. If you have that philosophy, that's what's going to end up.
Okay. Bungee jumping.
Huh?
Bungee jumping. Just jumping.
No, that's fine.
Fashion.
Okay, next. Okay, it says, you have all these tzoras that will come to you, and the Omar Hador HaAcharon, the final, last generation will say, and they'll make a cheshbon, why is all these things happening? Why did these terrible things happen? And they'll come to the conclusion because they left the Ribono Shel Olam and they abrogated the covenant, and that's why all these terrible things. Now, what is the Dor HaAcharon? Last generation of what? Last generation of existence? It's mashma that this is right before the Geula, and there'll be more generations. Why is this called Hador HaAcharon? There's a chazal that says that a person who does tshuva the last day of the year is like he did tshuva the whole year. There's something special about doing tshuva at the end of the year. And Chazal say, Hakol holech achar hagmar. Everything goes after how you finish. Right? How you finish something. Right? We know that finishing is a very important thing. Because when you finish something, you make a siyum. And you make a big party. Right? We also know that ein ha-mitzvah nikra el al shem gomra. The mitzvah is called on the name of somebody who finishes it. Even if somebody else started the mitzvah and somebody else came along and finished it, then the mitzvah is called on the name of the one who finished it. We learned that from Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu went and took the bones of Yosef when everybody else was going around getting gold and silver. He took the bones with him for 40 years and supervised them, but he didn't bury them. He didn't finish the mitzvah because he didn't go into Eretz Israel. So the Jewish people took over, right? And they buried the bones of Yosef in Shechem, and the Torah gives them the credit. V'yas'atzmos Yosef, asher helu b'nei Yisroel mi'eretz Mitzrayim. The bones of Yosef, which the Jewish people took out of Mitzrayim. They didn't take out of Mitzrayim, Moshe did. But since they finished the mitzvah, they got credit for it. So all these things point to the fact that when you finish something, that's very special. Yet, it says in Pirkei Avos, lo alecha hamalocha libmon. You don't have to finish anything. Not only that, Chafetz Chaim explains, we get rewarded for the effort. We don't have to finish anything to get rewarded. Whereas in the physical, material world, you get paid and rewarded for a finished product. If you don't finish anything, you don't get rewarded just for the work. Right. We work. And we get rewarded. They work, they don't get rewarded for the work, they get rewarded for the finished product. So all of that seems to say that finishing is not so important. Beyond that, it doesn't make any sense. I spent learning, you know, a Masechta in Gemara or a Sefer in Tanakh for 3 years. And every day or every week I put in hours into the shiur. And then the last day I would learn one line and make a big party. Right? If for one line you make a big party, you make a party every day for all that you learn. Well, it makes sense. Also, why in the world did the Jewish people get the credit for the mitzvah? I can understand, you know, if somebody does a mitzvah and he abandons it, and somebody else comes and saves it, you know, and he finishes it, that guy gets the credit, because this guy abandoned it. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't abandon the mitzvah. He would have loved to finish it. Except he died. He wasn't allowed to go into Eretz Israel. It wasn't his fault. So why in the world, just because the Jewish people finished it, and Moshe couldn't finish it beyond his control, was he deprived of the reward? It was called on the name of the Jewish people. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't seem fair. Therefore, what I think is the following. Finishing, a siyum, does not mean to celebrate finishing. Finishing is not a value to itself. In Torah, you don't have to finish. The value of a siyum is something else. The word siyum does not only mean to finish, but it has the following connotation. The Gemara says in Bava Basra that if you sell a field, when you write the document of sale, you have to identify the field by delineating the borders of the field in the shtar. For instance, you have to say, this field is bordered on the north by this candy store, and on the south by this gate, and so on. That's called l'sayim metzrinoi, to delineate, to identify the borders of the field. So the word siyu means to delineate, to identify. It means the following. If you have a puzzle, one of these, you know, 300-piece jigsaw puzzles, and you lost the box, so you have no idea what the picture is. You have all these little pieces, and they make absolutely no sense. How do they start making sense? When you start putting them together, you see, oh, this looks like the beginning of a hand, some fingers or whatever, but you have no idea what the hand's connected to. Then you got an arm, right? Little by little, the picture begins to make sense as you put the pieces together. When do you understand the import of every piece? When you put the last piece in. The last piece now gives you clarity and defines the entire puzzle. So it's that last piece that puts the whole thing into perspective. If you never learned and never heard anything that's in Sefer Bereishis, and you start learning Sefer Bereishis, you see, oh, God created the world. What? How many more days are coming? You don't know. So only after the initial chapter, when you see the whole 7 days, can you really appreciate what was done on the first day. But you really don't appreciate, okay, now there's a world, so what? Then you get to Adam and Chava, and Cain and Hevel, and Noah, And finally gets Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. You really can't appreciate any of these stories until you finish the book and you look back and you see the whole picture. That is the simcha of a seal. It is not celebrating finishing. It's celebrating being able to get a total picture, a full comprehensive perspective on what until now was piecemeal. That's the idea. The seal means that now you can see the whole thing in its true perspective, because you don't see something in its true perspective until you see the whole picture. When you see a fragment, it always is to a certain degree distorted and not really understood 100%. Therefore, a mitzvah also. Who can see the mitzvah in its real total perspective? Only somebody who saw the mitzvah from beginning to end. And only somebody who saw the mitzvah from beginning to end can bond with that mitzvah. It doesn't say that the Jewish people got the reward for the mitzvah and Moshe lost the reward. It said it was called on their name. In order for a mitzvah to be called on somebody's name, either they have to donate enough money or they have to bond with the mitzvah, right? Bonding with the mitzvah means that you can really appreciate that mitzvah in its totality. But if you can't, even a Moshe Rabbeinu, who only saw a portion of the mitzvah, he died before it was finished, couldn't bond with that mitzvah, so it wasn't called on his name. Of course he got the reward, but it wasn't called on his name. The Jewish people, on the other hand, saw their part, and they also saw what came before them, what Moshe did. They saw the mitzvah in its totality, they could bond with it. Therefore it was called on their name. So the idea of a seal is where you take a backward look and see the entire unit as a whole. And then you can make the proper, conclusions and really see it in its proper perspective. Now.
Same concept of
Makabe Patish? Well, yeah, it's like a concept of Makabe Patish, right? This puts everything, this completes it. This is a completion. Okay, now let's put it into the perspective of doing tshuva the last day of the year. It says if you do tshuva the last day of the year, it's like you did tshuva the whole year. But that doesn't make too much sense, because whenever you do tshuva, it's like you did tshuva from the time you did the sin. It's retroactive. So it doesn't make a difference the last day of the year, second day of the last year. Whenever you did it, it helps retroactively. So what's special about the last day of the year, if that's what it means? What I think it means is the following. A person opens a business. Since I never opened a business, I don't know 100% what I'm talking about, but what I'm telling you seems to make sense, so you open a business. So usually before you open the business, you have to buy stock. You have to rent a place, at least. You have to pay a deposit on the electric, gas, whatever. Okay. So the day you open the business, you look at your books, and you are $30,000 in the red. You say to yourself, this is ridiculous. I didn't even open my doors yet. I'm in debt. This is a losing business. No, but you have no choice. You open the doors. People come in and they buy out your entire stock in one day. Now you are $5,000 in the black. And you say to yourself, wow, if this goes on every day, I'm going to be a millionaire in no time. The next day, the electric bill comes in. You have to buy new stocks. You have to put out money. And, you know, you break even. So you say, okay, this is a pretty weak business. This goes on the whole year. Some days you're making tremendous profit. Some days you have losses, investment, whatever it may be. So how do you know if the business is a profitable business or a losing business or a stagnant business? How do you know? At the end of the year. At the end of the year, you take inventory and you add up all your profits, all your expenses, all your losses. And then, bottom line, you see whether the business is profitable or it's not profitable. The only time you can really see what the business is at the end of the year. Same thing goes with life. Some days we wake up in the morning and we're all gung-ho, and you know, and you daven, and you, what's it called, run to shul, and you pass a poor person on the way, and you give them tzedakah, and you're nice, and you treat your family nice, and by the time you go to sleep, you look at yourself and you say, wow, I'm a tzaddik. Mm-hmm. Then the next morning you get up late, miss davening, run through the street, kick over the poor person, you're grouchy, really miserable to your family. By the time you go to sleep, you say, I'm probably the worst Russia that exists. Next morning you wake up and you're somewhere in between. And this goes on a whole year. Some days you have up days, positive days, some days you have down days, and that's a human being with ups and downs. How do you know what you really are? Right? At the end of the year, and you look at all the ups and all the downs, and you're able to see, bottom line, the whole picture, now you really know where you're holding. So if you do tshuva at any point in the year, it's not tshuva of a whole year, it's a tshuva of a fragment. And you can't really do tshuva properly because you don't really see what you really are and who you really are, because you only see a fragment. When can you really see a whole year in its true perspective? At the end of the year. So a person who does tshuva the last day of the year, not that he does tshuva and it helps for the whole year, but it's a tshuva of the whole year, because now you can see the whole year in its proper perspective. Now you get a full picture. That's the idea of a siyum of the year. Therefore, there has to come a time, there are times in history when people stop and they look back and they complete a unit of history. And they say, look, this has got to stop and we got to change course. That's called Hador HaAcharon, bottom line. It's not the last generation of history, but it's the final generation before people realize that we can't go on just the way we are. We have to make an inventory, we have to assess what's going on, and we have to maybe change course. A generation that feels that they are the Dor HaAcharon, this is it, now's time for inventory. The time came to look back, to see the whole picture of everything till now, and to decide if we want to chart a new course or we just want to continue this course. Why have all these terrible things happened up until now, and how can we see that we should change the course of history? That's called Hador HaAcharon. Until there's a generation that feels that they want to see a bottom line and see everything before in a total perspective, you can't make changes. Because all you see is a fragment. You're part of the fragment, and you don't see the bottom line. But once you can feel that you want to come to a closure and see a bottom line, then you can make assessments and maybe change course or whatever. But it has to be a generation that feels that they are the Dor HaAcharon. We are now coming to the end of an era, and we want to assess that era and decide how to go on. That's what I think it means. Hador HaAcharon. Okay, one more thing. Yeah, I think so. We have time. It says that. Which one? Okay, let's see this one. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu, God called Yehoshua and Moshe into what's it called? Before the Ol Moed. And he, what's it called? This isn't for the post offices. So he, what's it called, called them together, and then he called Yehoshua alone, without Moshe Rabbeinu. And Yehoshua went in, and God spoke to him. When he came out, Moshe said, "What did God say?" He said, "Did you ever tell me what God said to you privately?" It was private. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, "I can't take this. What's it called? God, take me away. Right? This is too much. Right, my own student won't tell me what he said. I'm in the dark. God speaks to him and not to me." And he already said, "Take me away." Yehoshua was punished for that. And they forgot 300 halachas after Moshe died. They had to be brought back. Yehoshua was punished. That was a punishment. Question is, why did Yehoshua do such a thing? And pain Moshe Rabbeinu. So I was thinking that Yehoshua took the cue from God. Why did God call Yehoshua and speak to him privately and leave Moshe Rabbeinu standing outside? You know why? Because God wanted Moshe Rabbeinu to feel that, you know what, I think I've had my time over here in this world. And God does that to all of us. People get old and they get decrepit and they start losing their memory, right? They can't remember who the producer was of Around the World in 80 Days. And what? No. and aches and pains, and it's because since the Ribbono Shel Olam is getting a person ready to leave this world, he wants him to feel comfortable leaving and not to cling on or whatever. And that's when people get really, really old, and it serves his purpose. He makes the transition easier. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't old and he wasn't decrepit, and he was with all his full strength, and he had so many mitzvahs to do. The Rabbeinu Shalom wanted to spare him the anguish of knowing that he had to leave the world. This was his last day in the world. So he made it a little easier for him by taking Yoshua and showing him that, you know, Moshe, you're a has-been. So Yoshua said, oh, if God's doing it, I'm going to help her along. And I'm not going to tell Moshe Rabbeinu what he said. And he's really going to feel terrible. And he did it l'shem shamayim. So then why was he punished? Where do we find a similar thing? Penina. Chana didn't have children. Penina had children. And Penina used to mock and hurt Chana. Every time she would buy a new outfit for Yontif, for her children, she said, oh, Chana, how do you think your children would look in this outfit if you had them? Right? Or some other really biting things. And Penina was punished for that. But Penina was a tzaddikus. Why'd she do such a thing? Why'd she hurt Chana? Because she wanted her to daven. She wanted her to daven with such kavana that she'd have children. And she was successful. Because she chided her, Chana davened and cried her heart out. And because of that, she was answered. So Penina did Chana a favor. So why was she punished? The answer, and God does it. God made Moshe Rabbeinu feel bad so he'd feel good about leaving the world. So why was Yoshua punished for doing the same thing? I was thinking the idea is the following. No human being who is limited by time can hurt someone now for a future purpose. Only God can do that, because by God there is no time. So if I'm hurting you now and it's a future purpose, future, present, past are all the same. So it's not that I'm hurting you. At this point that I'm hurting you, it's really helping you because it all coalesces. But a human being is limited by time. So you're hurting me in the present for something that will be good in the future. You have no right to do that. You have no right to hurt me now, even though in the end it's going to work. God can do that because by God there's no time. God does that all the time. He does what makes us suffer now for a future good, but because God, by God there is no future, it's all the present. So therefore, it's 100% okay.
We punish our children, but then
the punishment is now you're giving them chinuch. But it's not only because what's going to be in the future. Right now it's beneficial, but over here, right now wasn't beneficial. It was only to make Moshe Rabbeinu feel good about it in the end. It wasn't an educational kind of thing. It was a bad now for a future benefit that would, you know, a human being's not allowed to do that. Only God can do that. That's why Penina was punished, and that's why Yoshua was punished.
What? The doctor does it.
No, but same thing. The doctor, what he's doing right now, the doctor sees as a, he's not hurting the person for he's healing. The healing hurts. But it's not a hurt now for a future benefit. It right now is an operation. It's a positive thing. But here there was nothing positive about chiding them. It only became positive because of what would be the spin-off. It's a very big difference. That you can't do.
No,
like
when
you
fact is, if the Rabbeinu Shalom says something and doesn't say tell, should I not tell?
Yeah, okay, but then Yoshua shouldn't have been punished. Then right, he right. didn't do it on his own.
Maybe it was the way he didn't tell.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what he said. Okay. You could whatever you want to say. Whatever it was that it was wrong. Why did he do that? And if he had a good reason, why was he punished? That's the. What?
He was
curious. he wanted to hear the Dvar Hashem. Right. God said something. I don't miss anything about what the Rabbeinu Shalom says. I want to hear every word. Right, a good Talmud, right? The Rebbe said something. What did he say?
He would know that, of course. Baruch Hu called Yoshua the law.
No, so if Yoshua told him, I would love to tell you, but God said, it's private. That's a different story. But he didn't say that. He said, did you ever tell me? So that already was a dagger in Moshe Rabbeinu's heart.
But he did teach him everything.
What? Yeah. But that's exactly the point. Yoshua already, you know, was big
so,
shot.
Right? Why would he say, did you ever tell me? He obviously taught him everything.
No, so he said, well, obviously you held back things from me. I'm going to... And that in itself hurt Moshe.
The question is, why 300 halachos? Why do we, you know...
Yeah, okay, the purpose of the shiur wasn't to explain that chazal.